Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LeDuc, the producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, August 7th, Joe was joined by Stuart Rice Honorary Chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences and Faculty Associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, Fran Berman, public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics Vera Icarius-Kelly, and former EPA Regional Administrator, Professor at Bennington College and President of Beyond Plastics, Judith Enck.
Kamala Harris, the Vice President of the United States, made the announcement that she was choosing Minnesota Governor Tim Walz as her running mate, the VP pick. And then just about dinner time in the city of Philadelphia, the wonderful city of Philadelphia where I grew up, they were in the on the campus of Temple University at a wonderful venue. And they had, I believe, 10,000 people, I think two or 3,000 people in an overflow room. And it was the unveiling of this ticket, of the Harris-Walz ticket. And it was quite the event. It started off with the guy who didn't get the job, but maybe never really wanted the job. The guy who didn't get the job, Josh Shapiro, who is the governor of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, speaking in just a fire and brimstone speech, just great, came out. And then a few moments later, it was the turn of Kamala Harris and introducing Tim Walz to the country and to the party faithful, and in a battleground state and getting ready to go to 7 battleground states over the next, I believe, 5 days, in anticipation of the Democratic convention in Chicago. So, a lot happening. It was a very lively speech, and I will just say that I think from a point of view of all of those in the campaign, I'm sure you all will feel how you all feel. But for the people that were responding yesterday, in the campaign and in the party, said this could not have gone any better. Like, this was what we wanted it to be, and it went off pretty much exactly as planned. And I think anyone who has any, even a brief brush with politics, knows that doesn't happen very often. So with that set up, I'll begin with Judith Enck.
Well, I think we need a new motto for this race. MAGA, make America joyful again.
Yes.
I think we need some like organic cotton hats and t-shirts, because they really are, you know, Kamala Harris on her own was bringing joy to the campaign. And like, who doesn't love Governor Walz? You know, we know the right wing attacks have begun. I think they're not going to land. Remember a couple of years ago, it was like, who do you want to sit down and have a beer with? And and I thought, well, you know, we're not electing our buddy. We're electing a leader. That was kind of the criticism of Al Gore. I would like to say on the record, I would like to sit down and have many beers with Tim Walz. He seems like an incredible person. I mean, I think having the vice president do his bio yesterday was really smart, because most people in America don't know who he is. I really just started paying attention to him last year when there was this beautiful image of him signing the bill providing free breakfast and lunch to children.
With all the children.
With all the kids, you know, surrounding him. I mean, that's
spontaneously hugging him.
Yeah, that's right. The ad, right? So I think this is very exciting. We need to brace ourselves for some pretty bizarre attacks. It's already started last night. Trump on Truth Social posted an almost incoherent rant. I still have difficulty, really believing that he doesn't drink heavily. I mean, I know he doesn't, but these rants are really bizarre, and many people don't want the media covering everything Trump says and does. I think it's now important that the media just run his words, run his speeches. Mm-hmm. We all had a little bit of a mental break from him, but you know, he's back. And mm-hmm. people need to hear his points. Final point is
not just bizarre, but creepy and weird. Let's
dangerous.
Just, yeah.
Very dangerous. So, you know, commentators were saying Vice President Harris's first week, oh, that's not going to last. That was just mm-hmm. a sugar high. Then we had the second week that went really well. And then we had the Olympics. And now we have Tim Walz as future mm-hmm. VP. Then we're going to have the convention. Then it's going to be Labor Day. The rally we saw last night is typically the political rally you see in Philadelphia in late October. We saw this in mm-hmm. August, and I think the momentum is just going to continue, but it is going to be a very, very tight race.
My favorite line from last night was, 90 days, we can do that, we can sleep when we're dead.
Right.
I love that. We can sleep when we're dead. That's a good way. And 90 days, it seems like, okay, that's
manageable.
We can get through this.
We can get through that.
Yeah. Vera.
So I wanted to say, I feel like my role today is to speak about the state of Minnesota. Many of you probably don't know, I was an undergraduate student at McAllister, a very international college in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I worked there for years.
Huh.
So You're practically
Canadian.
I'm part Minnesotan, I guess, based on that. And so I know
you
something
betcha.
About the economy. I know something about the people of Minnesota. I know the context a little better in terms of the regions. And I also wanted to point out the fact that when Tim Walz was chosen as VP, we will have the very first lieutenant governor mm-hmm. A member of the White Earth Band of Ojibwe Native American become a female indigenous governor of the state of Minnesota, which is a very interesting story itself.
Peggy Flanagan.
Peggy Flanagan, my first roommate at McAllister College was Ojibwe Native American. So for me, this is like fascinating to see that particular rise as well, right? So I'll be happy to sort of provide the Minnesota context today.
Can you do the accent?
well,
you can a little
I
bit.
I can a little bit.
Yes.
A little bit.
and we realized we found out yesterday that Mark Whitman also hailed for a period of time from the great state of Minnesota. Fran Berman.
Four things I love about this. Well, five if you count the fact that I am in studio with my very, very, very favorite everybody's. Number one, she had to do some political calculus. She had a number of folks. It took 3 weeks, which is a very short amount of time. Some of that was done behind the scenes, as it inevitably was. Some of that was done in public.
Yeah, they were
so
auditioning.
We had this kind of like mini vetting thing, and all of the folks were definitely above the bar. She did the political calculus. You know, it's a calculus that's so refined that, you know, I certainly don't understand all of the variables and all of the values to the variables.
Can I show you a picture on the radio?
Yeah.
Picture on the radio.
Please do.
This is a rally that took place last week in outside of Philadelphia. And
standing room only,
and the two speakers were Josh Shapiro and Gretchen Whitmer. And as you say, that they were going out on the, you know, the auditioning tour. And the most important thing about this tour or this picture is that it was taken at my high school gymnasium.
Oh my God!
This is where I graduated. This in that
cool.
room
on that
is
stage.
Where I on that stage is where I graduated. but again, I think it shows two things. One, to your point of the audition, but also the importance of Pennsylvania, not only for Josh Shapiro, but also just in the blue wall, as it were.
Well, and by the way, all of those folks should keep going out. you know, Whitmer should keep going out. Shapiro should keep going out. Yeah, Taylor Swift should keep going out.
They all intend to.
You know, all of them should keep going
Bruce
out.
Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce Springsteen, yeah.
Bruce.
Like,
Bruce
big fan.
Versus
John Legend. John Legend, keep
Kid
going out.
Rock.
Okay, number two. You know, I don't know him, but what I've heard from him, I think will really work. I think he's very down to earth. He's someone that he's funny. He's compelling. I can relate to him as far as I know. He seems to have had a complimentary background, which I think is going to be very, very useful for Harris. So that's great. Number three, one of the things that I've really, really loved is, well, three and four. Kamala Harris is a boss. Within about 5 picoseconds, she got enough delegates. She got everybody in the party to come out and say, you go, girl. Most important to me, she got Gen Z and the millennials. So, you know, we've all been, why did we do this? We've all been so burdened by the bizarreness and the creepiness of this campaign where, you know, Trump and all these folks come out as big giant bullies. And, you know, we're all kind of cowering. And, you know, they're a cat lady, they're a this. And the kids are going like, yeah, cat ladies for Kamala.
Well,
yeah,
how about,
I mean,
Tim
they,
Walz has a cat?
Yeah, it's like they've got the memes. They just see it for what it is, which is just weird, creepy stuff. Yeah. And Tim Walz is sort of that vein. So yeah. I think part of the joy is we're just calling it for what it is. You know, it's schoolyard bullying. It's crazy talk. It's And people are saying that, and, you know, that brings a lot of joy. So I think Walz is great with that.
I think also there seemed like many, many people were making the comparison. But there were a couple of shots yesterday about likening Tim Walz to Tim Kaine, who was the choice of Hillary Clinton when she ran. Mm-hmm. And it is, to me, a very, very different choice. I have nothing against Tim Kaine. He seems very, very nice. But I know more about Tim Walz now and assume that I will remember it forever, unlike that of Tim Kaine. and also, I think this speaks to Kamala Harris as well, that how they complement one another, how they already in this, and I told the story yesterday, but I heard a couple of other versions of it yesterday during the pre-official announcement, which is in the moments after Biden announced that he was stepping aside, one of the first phone calls that Kamala Harris made in that rash of 100 phone calls was to Tim Walz. And she kept on checking in with him throughout the day, not in looking for a vice presidential candidate, but instead looking to a governor for advice and what she was looking for and what she should do. And apparently the two at that point bonded, and there was a great trust in each other and the information that was given throughout the day and throughout the days after that announcement, as all of a sudden she's on this track to become the Democratic nominee.
Let me say one thing,
yes.
and then Teresa, I'm sorry.
No, don't be sorry.
You.
It's all great.
Make no mistake about this. This is leadership. Kamala Harris is showing good sense, strategic sense, joy, and leadership in the way she's handling this campaign. She inherited a whole bunch of people who knew what they were doing, but leadership makes all the difference because these are the same people, many of them, who were in charge of the Biden campaign, which was falling short. She has gotten all of her stakeholders behind her. She's energized the electorate. This is leadership. This is what I want to see in my president. So you go, girl. Okay, Teresa, sorry.
So I think stepping back, yesterday was the anniversary of the signing of the Voting Rights Act 59 years ago, 1965, that guaranteed African Americans the right to vote, made it illegal to impose restrictions on federal, state, local elections that were designed to deny the vote to Black people and other minorities. And I just think that this is an amazing reminder of how far we've come. As I was watching that scene, last night and thinking about how what a really historic transformational campaign this is. And in 2026, we're going to celebrate the 250th anniversary of our country, right? Mm-hmm. And this may sound hokey, but I've been thinking, like, who do we want to represent us at that point in history, like what we are as a country? And on the stage last night was a perfect, you know, symbol of the kinds of people. I mean, the choice is that Trump is president in that anniversary, or when we go back to the moon, which is also going to happen about the same time. But as we look back at our history and look forward, aren't they the two amazing examples of what we are and what we could become as a country? That's all I kept thinking about last mm-hmm. night, of how far we've come, how far we have to go. And then the second thought about is exactly what you all said in one way or the other, is since the day that President Biden agreed to step aside, which I still think is incredible in terms of transfer of power, you know, a seceding power for the next generation to accede. She, Kamala Harris, from the get-go, has demonstrated leadership that I don't think people, I know I didn't give her credit mm-hmm. for having. I mean, she has unlocked and unleashed this incredible joyful energy. And joyful is the word that keeps coming up, and that is the word for it. And I think by bringing in the Governor Walz, it does help shore up the blue wall, right? Because he will appeal to the whole country, but particularly those key Midwestern states they call the blue ball that you need to win. And he, like she, has a uncanny ability to really strike at the heart of the concerns that many people have about Trump, but do it in a way that is not mean or nasty. You know, they make the point, but then they get to where we're going, but they don't do it in a mean or nasty way. And so, you know, you can object without being objectionable. Right? And that's what they're doing. Yeah. The way that she presents her bio and then just says, I know his type. The I know his type mm-hmm. line is masterful. And then it's also, his is a me campaign and hers is a we campaign. And yeah. I think that that's really the we campaign. And that leads me to my final point, that I think if the election were held today, he would win, I think. I'm not sure, but I think that this is a masterful beginning. But really, it's up to all of us. If this is, you know, what do we want? Who do we want representing our country? And it's now up to us to take all that energy that's been brought together, all those people that have come together, all these groups, and turn that energy into action, which turns into votes.
And let's get the pulse of the people and get some letters, see what they have to say about all of this. Shiloh writes to us and says, TikTok, at least my side of mm-hmm. the algorithm, loves Tim Walz.
And it crashed yesterday.
Lots of people are reflecting on how having Walz in the ticket feels like getting the dad parent that they lost to Fox News back. That's great. The current state of the race is being described as cool wine mom versus grill dad versus your racist uncle and creepy cousin.
Oh, I love that. I love that.
Genuine enthusiasm, hope, and joy all around regarding the ticket. There was that moment during the event last night where Tim Walz just turned to Kamala Harris and says, "Thank you for bringing joy back to the campaign."
Yes.
And whether that was a planned line or an unplanned line, it doesn't matter, because it just seemed like true. I mean, when was the last time that you haven't? I have my sort of Vulcan fingers looking over my eyes, where or my hand in front of my eyes, where you're sort of looking at the TV, just waiting to go, oh God, what's going to happen next?
Yeah.
Where we didn't have to worry about that as much or at all.
I thought about it in the signs that they were holding up versus in the Trump campaign, the signs are you're fired. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in the hers is we win, right? Yeah. It's like negative versus positive. It's just...
It feels like the Obama campaign.
No, that's what
people
are
again. It does.
It has really
energy,
has...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Much more focused on addressing people's needs and hopeful policy discussions and ideas for how to make things better, not just complaints about what's wrong and how and to grievance. Go backwards and grievances. And right. yeah, it's a totally different
it's
tone.
All
it's about
going
the
forward.
Public good.
Right.
Yeah.
Woo-hoo.
Well, what a concept.
What a concept.
Back and to letter. Go ahead.
I just, for anybody listening, if you haven't, look up the video about with Walls and his daughter at the State mm-hmm. Fair.
His daughter named Hope.
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 Oh,
yes.
His daughter's
She's
named Hope.
She's a breakout star.
She is amazing. Yeah. There are a number of things that he's done with her in the car about putting your phone down, mm-hmm. and the two of them back and forth about how important it is to put your phone down. Just precious. You got to look up both of them. But the one at the State
yeah.
Fair.
How old is she?
22 maybe.
Yeah, early 20s.
Okay. She's in college. My favorite line in that is they're going to the State Fair and he's talking about food options.
Yes.
And she says she's a vegetarian and he says, you can have turkey. And she says, I'm a vegetarian. And he says, well, in Minnesota, turkey is
vegetarian.
I'm the governor. No, you're not. No, it was hysterical. It's just really, it's adorable.
Well, he's a farm country guy. You know,
grew
I mean,
up in
he
Nebraska.
He did grow up in Nebraska, and he lived in southern Minnesota, Mankato, which is vast farm country. Soybean, corn, and turkey is one of the biggest exports.
But let's talk about the mm-hmm. beginning of his career. Mm-hmm. You know, he ran in 2006 and he beat a Republican incumbent in his congressional district. Mm-hmm. As you say, Vera, is very conservative. It's a rural district. And he reflected that. So, mm-hmm. you know, his voting record in Congress is different than his public mm-hmm. record as governor. But what I'm so impressed with is he voted for an important climate change bill involving cap and trade. Many Democrats who did that in tight races then lost, but he went on and won again in 2010, narrowly.
Yeah.
And he represented his district. It was not mm-hmm. an easy district. I mean, I think Trump won that district by 15 points.
20.
A lot. And I think it just shows his appeal. And I don't want to end the party prematurely, you know, Trump is going to throw everything he has.
Oh, absolutely.
He's currently ahead in many polls, but I do want to point out there's a new Marist poll of independent voters. 2 weeks ago, Kamala Harris was behind by 12 points, and now she's ahead of Trump by 9 points among independent voters nationally. Mm-hmm. And that was before she selected her running mate.
3 points nationally, according to the NPR Marist poll. And we'll talk about that.
Yeah, and the key thing, though, I think, is keeping an eye on the independents, because Trump's voters are locked in. You know,
right.
It's
not
the same
shift.
Ceiling yep. and floor. Mm-hmm. The race will be won by who can attract independents in swing states.
Yep.
I don't pay a lot of attention to national polls because the Democrats are going to win
anything.
In California and hopefully, you know, states like New York.
Mm-hmm.
And so the numbers get skewed because there are so many voters in those states. So it's the swing state polls that we have to really carefully keep our eye on. But she and he are the underdogs. And the thing about Trump is he's not going to just be campaigning hard and campaigning dirty to win. He will be campaigning to keep himself out of jail
right.
because he's counting on self-pardoning himself on a number of things. Eventually, these trials are going to happen.
Right.
And I think if he loses his campaign, he most definitely will be serving some jail time.
Judith Eng on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, August 7th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, August 8th, Joe Donahue was joined for the panel conversation by the Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at UAlbany, Robert Griffin, The Empire Report's J.P. Miller, and CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan.
So, this is fun. Trump's complaining. Donald Trump is complaining. It's the head of the Washington Post, and it tickled me. The headline being, Trump complains about the campaign as advisors try to focus on attacking Harris. So apparently the gist of the article is that the former president, Donald Trump, is very upset about Kamala Harris's crowd size. He's very upset by the amount of media attention that she and now Governor Walz are getting. He's very upset by the polling numbers, which were indicated initially a blowout and now are really too close to call, although Trump is still leading at this moment in many of the battleground states. But the momentum of the campaign has clearly shifted to that of Vice President Kamala Harris and Governor Tim Walz. And you have the announcement this week, which of course has put them into the news cycle. And then you're going to have the actual convention, which is also going to put them into the news cycle once again. And Trump is wondering what to do. And his campaign is saying, well, here you go. Why don't you just go after her and stay focused on it? And so he mocked, yesterday just called her pathetic, I think was the line that he used. And staffers and allies are gathering and talking about, this is a group, by the way, real quick, this is a group, by the way, that during the convention was basically measuring the drapes for their desk and their offices in the White House. And then things turned, and God knows, I mean, who knows what's going to happen this election? We saw a month like no other last month. Who knows what the future is going to hold, and who knows who's going to win? And I don't think anybody knows. But there was a great sense that this was a campaign that they could win. That has been lessened. And now, from the press accounts, former President Trump is a little grumbly about it. No happiness there, Bob.
Well, it brings me great happiness, Joe. So.
JP, what do you think?
Yeah, how you described the sequence of events, Joe, was spot on and beautiful. Trump did have a couple weeks after that debate where he looked like he was almost certain to be the next president. And I think he's got to be looking back on that choice to debate Biden as maybe the most consequential mistake of his campaign. Had he not agreed to debate Biden until after the Democratic convention, Biden would be locked in as the nominee and he could then go off to victory. So I think that he is likely very upset that he chose to debate Biden at that time. And Vice President Harris and now Governor Walz are in their honeymoon phase, and that honeymoon phase is going to last another 2 weeks. It's hard to imagine a way that Trump is going to be able to reverse that momentum. And I think he's also coming to the realization that before Biden dropped out, there was an incumbent versus challenger dynamic in the race, which is Biden was the incumbent. All of the problems with the country were resting on Biden's shoulders as the incumbent president, and Trump was the challenger saying, we can remember how great things were 4 years ago. We can go back to the way that was. There is no longer an incumbent challenger race. There is now what I would classify as a new fresh face of the Democratic Party, which is attracting huge crowds. Crowd size does matter in a big way, and you see that Vice President Harris and Governor Walz are attracting huge crowds. And so you've got this new fresh face that America is really being introduced to Vice President Harris for the first time. She, of course, is a known entity, but she is having her coming out party now versus so it is not an incumbent. It is a new fresh face versus a former president who has always been a very flawed candidate. And so when you see Trump thinking that he's losing and becoming desperate, you're going to see him throw Hail Marys. You're going to see him. And when Trump throws a Hail Mary, they are doozies. You're going to see him level big charges. You're going to see him bring in the race card and the gender card and all those things. Whereas when it was him with Biden, you were seeing glimpses of Trump, what you might call a disciplined candidate. He was being coy and quiet and letting kind of Biden blow himself up. This race has now turned into a toss-up, and I would even say that Vice President Harris has the edge right now going into the Labor Day weekend. And we will see what a desperate Trump does. I predict long Hail Marys and attacks on her race and her gender.
There was a line in this article in the Washington Post where Trump told an ally in a phone call last weekend, "It's unfair that I beat him, and now I have to beat her too."
I love that. I mean, that's just classic Trump. I think the best thing here is that he is so used to dominating the news cycle, dominating social media, and she's better at it. And right now, and I'm sure the campaign is being very intentional in talking about how big the crowds are and the size of the crowd, because those are things that trigger him. And he's it's working. And when you trigger him, he goes off message and he says dumb things and he turns people off. I mean, who in their right mind goes to speak to the Black Journalist Association and questions whether or not the Black candidate for president is really Black? I mean, when he's off message, he really messes up. And I think that's not a bad strategy by the Harris-Walz campaign to try and tick him off and get him riled up. And the whole, like, oh, it's not fair. And now he's somehow, defending Biden's, this being taken from him and characterizing that way. Nobody but him thinks of it that way. He's trying to create some kind of narrative about that. But I think that's so far off message and so far away from the things that are to his benefit. He had lots of opportunities to show that he was a new person after the assassination attempt. And for about 5 seconds, he stayed on message. And as soon as he went off message, any of the goodwill that might have accrued to him up to that point was all out the window. And if they keep him like this, if they keep him in this agitated state and people start talking about, oh, is he going to dump his VP candidate? It was a huge mistake. All of these things he takes so personally, and he turns into this sort of petulant child, oh, it's not fair. I think the whole thing is fascinating. There's so much psychology involved here. And I have to say, I think that it's been very effective so far in getting him sort of into this place where he does not look like a viable candidate to the people that he needs to get as voters.
Just in the moments since we started talking about this, the New York Times has published a Maggie Haberman report that says that Donald Trump plans to hold a general news conference on Thursday afternoon at his home, Mar-a-Lago, the first such event he's held in months. He announced that on Truth Social this morning. Haberman writes, "The former president's prominence in news coverage has slipped since President Biden abruptly announced last month that he was ending his reelection campaign and then endorsed Vice President Kamala Harris, who secured the Democratic Party's presidential nomination this week. Mr. Trump has been seeking ways to make headlines, but He has also sought to highlight how Ms. Harris has yet to give interviews and allow reporters to pose wide-ranging questions since she became a presidential candidate. Trump really hasn't done this either. When he was during his civil court case, he owned a building nearby and would go in and would answer a few questions. But that has not occurred in months. And then, of course, there's the whole back and forth debate over the debate as to whether that is going to happen or not. We can talk about that a little bit later on. Bob Griffin.
But you know what Trump hasn't been doing is that he hasn't been on the campaign trail. When you think about at least the last few days, he has ceded the pole position to Harris and Walz, and this whole J.D. Vance sort of going up and pathetically trying to measure the airplane yesterday was, I think, just shows you the continued missteps from the campaign. I think the campaign really thought that they would have an armchair run where they could sit back and let Biden self-destruct, and all Trump would have to do is to keep his mouth shut, which is in itself a huge task. And they are completely unprepared to deal with this new reality. They're unprepared to deal with the enthusiasm. I would recommend to anybody who doesn't understand what we're talking about with the enthusiasm gap, just look at the crowds between a Harris event and a Trump event. Just look what the crowds are doing within the venues themselves. And you see a level of enthusiasm that I think heartens back to sort of the Obama times, which is, you know, this is before the convention, but this is exactly the type of spirit that you're looking to see, particularly as colleges come back into play, as students get back on campus, as the race really starts to intensify. Heather, the comments about, you know, sort of Trump being Trump, you know, his ability to sow chaos, I think, will raise significant questions in some of the key constituent areas, mm-hmm. like in some of the suburbs and some of the key sub-constituencies. Like, do we really want to put ourselves, you know, through this again? So forcing, you know, the Harris switch really forces the GOP and Trump specifically to have to campaign differently, and they're not. The other element of the campaign that they'll toss out, and I'll be interested in the perceptions of the panelists and the letter writers, is I like the tone. I like the tone of, you know, the joyful warrior. Okay, we're going to be strong. And I like the way that Harris responded to some of the hecklers in the event. That, you know, she rolled with it, but she didn't bow to it. I look at some of the comments, though, coming out of Trump from some of his senior campaign officials that, frankly, are mind blowing to me. Like talking about the smell on the vice president's airplane. I'm like, what are you doing? I mean, seriously, as an adult, what are you doing? As someone who's trying to prove to the country that this organization is fit to take over the reins of power again, you're acting less than juvenile. And that's the theme that I'm seeing. And I'm looking at the polls, and, you know, yeah, it's still a tight race, but the trajectory of the polls are exactly where I would want to be at if I was advising the Harris-Walz campaign. And then what we're starting to see now is the recycled attacks on, you know, the military record of Walz, on Harris, on her, you know, her American heritage. I mean, it's sort of like they're throwing, the GOP right now is throwing all of the garbage attacks that have worked from Swift Boat all the way on into the blender to see if they can find any way to stop the progression or momentum of the Harris campaign.
If you call everybody a loser and an idiot and stupid, and I mean, after a while, that loses its effectiveness. And you, now I say this as he's been a major political figure for 9 years, but still, in this campaign just seems to be, okay, he's doing it again.
Yeah. What I've noticed about since Vice President Harris has become the nominee and Governor Walz has become the vice presidential nominee is that in past campaigns, the opposing campaign would gather opposition research on their opponent, and they would roll out week by week, here's something that Vice President Harris said, or this is something that J.D. Vance said, or this is something that Governor Walz said. And in the age of Twitter and Instagram, all of their past comments, the minute that they are announced as the candidate, all of their past controversial comments are distributed to everybody within 24 hours and kind of digested by everybody within 24 hours. And so what I think that the another thing that Trump is frustrated with is there is not a clear line of attack versus Vice President Harris. Is she a radical liberal? Is she a flip-flopper? You know, it's hard to pin down for the Trump campaign what they're going to attack her on, whereas Biden, it was easy. He's old and senile. He's you know, he can't be the president. And so I think that that's another area of frustration you're seeing on the part of the Trump campaign, which is there has not been anything uncovered in Vice President Harris's or Governor Walz's past that is really a great attack line for them. On the other hand, J.D. Vance has had a much less successful rollout than Harris and Walz in that the first 3 days of his candidacy, it was over and over new videos of him basically calling the former president, you know, a rapist, unfit for office, his supporters are deranged and all that stuff. So you've seen three rollouts over 3 weeks, Vance, Harris, and Walz. And Vance's has gone by far the worst out of those three. And Harris and Walz are they're on their honeymoon phase from now until August 22nd and beyond.
J.P. Miller on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, August 8th. We'll be back with the final segment of this week's show after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Weekend Review. On Friday, August 9th, Joe Donahue was joined for the panel conversation by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Hendler, and Siena College Professor of Economics, Aaron Pasitti.
Wall Street is on edge after a week of wild swings. Investors now have a factor to consider beyond the pace of inflation. Could the next sign of too slow economic growth send stocks into a tailspin? The top article of the New York Times at the moment, and this just about 10 minutes before Wall Street opens on this Friday morning, and a week after things were precarious.
So the stock market is not the economy. That's the main takeaway I want people to have from this. The stock market represents expectations of corporate profits, but more regularly, the psychology of investors. People turn to the stock market and movements in the stock market because it's a simple number. It goes up, good. It goes down, bad. But for half the population, movements in the stock market are irrelevant because the poorest 50% of the country does not own any stock in any form. The richest 1% of the population owns 50% of all stock wealth. The richest 10% of the population owns 90% of all stock wealth. So movements in the stock market primarily affect the richest 10%. So it's not a concern. It has no real effect on about 90% of the population's day-to-day existence. So what happened was, on Friday, the Bureau of Labor Statistics released their monthly jobs report for July, and it came in lower than expected. The economy created 114,000 jobs, which was one of the lowest since the pandemic recovery. And markets all of a sudden decided that this was the end of the world, that it's a low number, it came in below expectations, that a recession must be imminent. And I think what, I mean, at this point, now that the dust has settled, it's pretty clear that markets overreacted, that this is 1 month of data. The Federal Reserve has been trying to slow job growth since they've been raising interest rates, but not generate, you know, a negative change in job growth. So this is what the Federal Reserve has been trying to accomplish and has been telegraphing for years. So the S&P was down 5.5% from their mid-July, from its mid-July peak. It rose 2.3% yesterday, so it's gaining back a lot of those losses. But the important thing to remember is that it's up 12% since the beginning of the year. So the sign that there was this weekly panic that was precipitated by a big sell-off in Japanese markets, and then people saw that and said, oh, maybe there's something wrong, and then they started to sell. And that panic can feed on itself and create a self-reinforcing cycle where people are selling because they see other people selling. And normally what happens is that either that continues indefinitely, like or for a long time like it did in 2008, and you see a real market crash, or what's more likely to happen this time is that there's no real sign of a slowdown in corporate profits. There's no sign that the labor market is teetering on the brink of a massive increase in unemployment. It's just overreaction and not something most people are affected by. A lot of other economic reports slowing down in inflation, increased economic growth. The Federal Reserve's been saying we're going to start lowering rates. All of these things are good for growth and good for stock markets. So it was an overreaction to one data release.
So let me ask you, I've read this headline in the Times about 17 times, and I'm still trying to figure out what it means. Investors now have a factor to consider beyond the pace of inflation. Mm-hmm. Could the next sign of sputtering economic growth send stocks into a tailspin? Well, aren't there always going to be signs of sputtering economic
sure.
growth? So
there are hundreds of different economic reports that come out every week.
So this just tells me that we're waiting to send stocks into a tailspin.
Yeah. So what I think is happening right now, the bigger picture is that the stock market has had an incredible bull run since the pandemic recovery started. I mean, the increase in stock prices has been more than anyone has anticipated. A lot of that has been driven by technology stocks. There was the big NVIDIA sell-off, which I'm sure Jim can talk more about. But, you know, you have a disproportionately small number of big tech stocks, Meta, Apple, NVIDIA, I'm sure I'm forgetting a couple, Google, others.
Microsoft.
And they're in everything. They're in all of
that. Yeah, and, you know, so are stocks overvalued? You can make that point, and a market correction is certainly something that we is likely to happen. But the weird thing is that stock prices tend to move in the opposite direction as interest rates. So when the Federal Reserve was raising interest rates for the past 2 years, stock prices should have come down because higher interest rates make the cost of borrowing higher, which should limit business investment and depress profit growth. Well, that didn't happen. So now what you're seeing is now that the Fed's saying we're going to start lowering interest rates, all of a sudden up is down and down is up, and stock prices are falling because they think the Fed lowering interest rates is a sign of economic weakness, so stock prices are falling. And you just have – there's a lot of signals that are being misread and a lot of misfirings that are happening. So a slow market correction is inevitable. I think we're riding the big boom. And usually that these big, you know, money managers aren't just going to sell because they think the market's high. They're waiting for some more concrete evidence, whether it's a jobs report or, you know, slower GDP growth or rising loan delinquencies. We're not seeing much of that.
Jim? I was just going to throw in one other factor, which is a few years ago, some of my colleagues started noticing that stock swings were getting bigger and bigger. And that, you know, a down market day went from being 200 down to 500 down to 1,000 down. Yesterday, 600 up. And it's not clear, you know, again, causation is not correlation. The fact that Aaron didn't show up last Friday may or may not have actually caused the bad job report. But electronic trading has sped up some of this. So what can happen is I can now put in something that says, if this stock goes below a certain level, immediately sell it. And I don't have to be in the loop to make a decision. So now what happens is often if the market starts going down, a lot of decisions get made very quickly using combinations of AI, handwritten rules, mm-hmm. special purpose programs. The amount of money that Wall Street puts into computer programs for trading is just staggering. Great source of employment for our students.
Right.
But so it's not that it's all computers doing this, but it's definitely the case that we've seen an acceleration in the size of these things. So it used to be, you know, 1,000 points off and people were jumping off ledges. Now 1,000 points off, it's let's see what happens tomorrow.
Right.
Let's go to a couple of letters. And did you want to, anything you wanted to say about our economic precariousness?
Just a couple of things, which are more in the form of questions. One of the things that I read about in the jobs report, there's a lot of concern that unemployment was increasing. Mm-hmm. But I read that a good portion of that is that people who had been on the sidelines into the market. So what appears to be on its surface bad news, wasn't that actually good news?
Right. So one of the big reasons was that so to be considered part of the labor force, you have to have a job or have actively looked for a job in the past 4 weeks. So if you don't have a job but are looking for but have looked for a job in the past 4 weeks, you're considered unemployed. So for workers who don't have a job but haven't actively been looking for a job in the past month, they're not counted as unemployed. They don't show up in the unemployment rate. So as the economy improves, as the labor market improves, those workers who were out of the labor force on the sidelines they re-enter and start looking again, so they get counted as unemployed. But that's a good type of unemployment because it's a sign that workers are confident that there are jobs out there, so they start re-entering the labor force with the hopes of eventually finding work.
Right. So that was a little sunshine. It will look like gloom. And,
thank you.
And
that's,
so
yeah, no, that's an excellent
all of
point.
The people who were, you know, the Republicans, gloom and doom. The other good economic news this week, I thought, was the interest rates for houses, which is particularly concern for housing, are going down. Now, I still think that interest rates at 7%, because I'm old enough to remember double-digit mortgage rates, but I didn't mean interest rates, I meant mortgage rates. Yeah. So mortgage rates are now down to about 6%, which is astounding. I mean, they've taken a dramatic drop in the last week or two, haven't they?
Yeah. So it's not that all economic news is good, that mortgage rates went up because the Federal Reserve raised interest rates to essentially slow economic activity, and that primary operates through the housing channel, that when the Fed raises rates, mortgage rates go up, it slows house buying activity, it slows construction, and then that, you know, trickles out, diffuses to the rest of the economy. So the Fed's been telegraphing that they're going to be lowering rates. With what's been happening, you're probably looking at 5 or 6 rate cuts between now and the end of 2025. So investors are starting to price that in to the mortgages that they offer. So that's good news for home buyers. It's good news to people who carry a balance on their credit card that their interest rates will go down. Good news for people who are looking to buy a car. Anybody who's looking to borrow money should look at the next, you know, year, the remainder of 24 and the rest of 25 as a good time to do so because rates are going to be falling.
Right, right.
We got this letter from John, has already been mentioned. Stocks are driven by computers and not by thousands of individual investors deciding to buy or sell. So when the jobs report comes out, it gave the signal to the computers to sell.
Sure. I mean, as Jim pointed out, you can have these algorithms that can be triggered by whatever you want them to be triggered by. Right. If the unemployment, you could have an if-then clause where if the unemployment rate comes in below expectations, then sell X percent of my holdings.
Well, and you can also do that on individual stocks. Right. Things like that. So, in fact, one of the things that people reported, again, I only have this anecdotally because I know NVIDIA pretty well, is that when it started to go down, a lot of things sold with the plan to buy low because they knew it was eventually going to come back up again. Okay. Right, that kind of thing. So if you're looking for a short gain,
a
good way to do it is to force the market down.
Sean writes, are your statistics about the percentage of people owning stock accurate with respect to those who have the retirement accounts in 401k plans, etc.? With fewer pension plans available to workers, more are in these type of accounts, and therefore aren't changes in the market often super worrisome to these folks?
That's a good question, and that was one that was asked off-air during break. That data comes directly from the Federal Reserve's Survey of Consumer Finances. So it is a shocking number that people earning approximately below $60,000 to $70,000 control as a group hold less than 1% of all stock wealth. So that includes pension funds. A lot of people don't contribute to their pension funds. Just because they have access to them doesn't mean they're contributing money. So yeah, it's a ugly reality that people like to ignore. But again, 90% of all stock wealth is held by the richest 10%. So for the remainder of the population, even with 401ks, even with defined benefit pension plans, whatever pension plan there is, most people lack stock wealth. Most people don't have a significant amount of stock wealth.
But I wonder about, with all this talk, recession, does that have a self-fulfilling prophecy and so changing the mood? Because it's not just one person. It's this whole echo chamber.
Stock markets have predicted 10 of the last 5 recessions. what causes a recession are decreases in consumer spending, which is usually driven by rising unemployment or, sharply decreasing wage growth. We don't see any of that. Recessions are driven by decreases in, business investment. We're not seeing that. What could happen is that increased stock volatility, bigger downswings followed by bigger upswings, that can get into a feedback loop. But just the psychology of, we think we're in a recession, therefore recessionary conditions emerge, usually doesn't happen because, if you look at consumption levels, even adjusting for inflation, they're just continuing to increase. So if people think there's a recession, they're certainly not spending.
Right.
They're certainly not spending like they're in a recession now.
Aaron Pasitti on the Roundtable panel on Friday, August 9th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are posted online at WAMC.org or in the WAMC app or wherever you find your podcasts. This has been the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.